This class is brought to you by our friends at Sumis, the revolutionary health benefit solution that gives employees unheard of access to top medical specialists across the full range of medical specialties, and employers a proven way to significantly lower their enterprise-level healthcare spend. It's a transformation of access made possible by Sumis's unique marketplace model that in as little as a day connects employees across the country with over 5,100 of the best specialists at the nation's top medical centers through an elegant, simple, medium-agnostic platform, and a human relationship-based user experience. The quality of Sumis's solution is unrivaled. They are currently delivering 7 to 10 times higher employee engagement, a 9.4 out of 10 employee satisfaction rate, and all while driving meaningful and measurable healthcare cost savings for the companies they serve. Now, we are delighted Sumis customers, as are many companies in our ecosystem, all of which are having amazing results, both in better health outcomes and material cost savings. So if you're looking for a benefit that provides huge value to both your employees and your bottom line, visit sumisglobal.com. That's SUMMUSglobal.com.
Hello, and welcome to The Art of Investing, the podcast devoted to helping you more fully experience the joys of compounding in all its forms. I'm Paul Buser.
And I'm Rick Berman.
We are your hosts. In each session, our teachers will be some of the world's most compelling people from across the vast range of human achievement. Take your seats. Class is in session.
This show is brought to you by Pine Grove Studios in collaboration with Colossus. The hosts of the show, Rick Berman and Paul Buser, are the co-founders and co-CEOs of Seda Grove Holdings and co-CEOs of Seda Grove Management Company. All opinions expressed by any of Rick, Paul, or their podcast guests are solely their own and do not reflect the opinion of either Seda Grove Holdings or Seda Grove Management Company. This podcast is intended for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as the basis for investment decisions. Seda Grove Holdings or clients of Seda Grove Management Company may maintain positions and securities discussed in this podcast.
In today's session, we're joined by two of our very best former students, Drew Tranquil and Joe Schmidt. In typical Joe and Drew fashion, this conversation was wide-ranging and totally energizing for us. You're going to hear about Drew's improbable run to becoming Super Bowl champion with the Kansas City Chiefs. This was after he had a history of battling back from multiple season-ending injuries. You're also going to get to know Joe, a former walk-on at Notre Dame, turned team MVP, who then went on to become a venture capitalist at two of the most storied firms in the world, Accel and now Andreessen Horowitz. Stepping back, we're just in awe of the way Joe and Drew embrace life with a sense of joy that is so infectious to all those around them. We think this joyful attitude might actually be the key to their extraordinary success so early in their careers. In fact, after Rick and I reflected on the conversation we had with them, the old proverb came to mind about the student becoming the master. And we think after listening that you'll agree that this is absolutely the case with these two legendary students. I hope you enjoy our conversation with our good friends, Joe Schmidt and Drew Tranquil. Come on, woo! Before we jump into class, I wanted to take a moment to highlight an initiative we talked about last year in Art of Investing with our good friend, Brad Gerstner. Alongside his day job managing Altimeter, he and a dedicated team had been working hard on an innovative legislative proposal to give each child a 401k from birth. Their vision is to enable everyone to learn about and share in the upside of America. We recently caught up with Brad, and the team is making terrific progress in DC and with many of the largest companies in the United States. We encourage you to check out the Invest America 24 feed on X to learn more about all the great things they're up to and to find out ways to help.
Boys, so good to see you. Two of our favorite former students doing amazing things in the world. Let's start first with the Kansas City Chiefs and Drew Tranquil, coming off of one of the most extraordinary moments, I have to think, for any football player, being part of a team to win the Super Bowl. Just start by trying to put into context, in as much detail as you can, what it actually feels like just coming off of that kind of an achievement.
Yeah, I don't know, Rick, that you can necessarily put words to it. There's moments in the day where I think it's the reflection on the road to get there that really awes me the most. And not necessarily just this season. We beat Miami, beat Buffalo, had to go to Baltimore, and then beat San Francisco. But if you were to take me back 8-10 years ago, after tearing my second ACL or tearing my first ACL and rehabbing with this man, Joe Schmidt. I just feel so blessed and unlikely, I guess, to be in this situation. And it's a spectacular feeling and moment. And certainly the people you share it with are, I think, what make it the most special.
I was going back looking at some of your tweets, and just after winning the AFC championship, you shared a screenshot of a text from Coach Reed that I assume took place around when you were making the decision with Jackie on whether to join the Chiefs. And it was really powerful, just his short message, basically making himself available to you for anything, but then also capping it off by saying, till then, see red and think Super Bowls. You really stepped into a situation where the expectations for the team, obviously bordering on, if not at this point, becoming the first dynasty in a while in professional football, but also with the expectations on your own shoulders for coming in and playing a very specific role. Maybe just talk about what that decision was like to first interact with Coach Reed and others on his staff, and what that kind of proposition felt like just over a year ago today when you made that pivot from the Chargers to the Chiefs.
Yeah, I guess maybe to give a little bit of context is I was an unrestricted free agent after last season, coming off probably my best season with the Chargers in my four-year stint there. And by all means, my wife Jackie and I thought for sure that we'd be back in Los Angeles with the Chargers, probably on a multi-year deal. And that ended up not panning out the way we expected it to or thought it would. And so it led us into this position in free agency where we had a ton of one-year offers on the table. And it's funny how when things don't go expected, like sometimes there's just an absolute blessing waiting behind the door. And that certainly was the case for my wife and I. When I was making that decision between the five or six teams we were choosing between, I really felt like Andy Reid, Steve Spagnuolo, Brett Veach, the Hunt family, everybody involved in that decision really valued what I brought to the table. And they kept saying time and time again, I can't believe we're even having this conversation because we didn't think we'd have the opportunity to even get you. I think what I appreciated most was obviously those silly texts from Coach Reed, but it's deeper than that. It's the fact that he valued me as a person. He saw me as an asset and someone who could help their team go back to back. And I think that's a little bit of what we're all looking for in life, is to bring valuable reps to whatever we're doing, feel a part of something bigger than ourselves. And I felt like I had the opportunity to do that. And I think for me, I don't know where your listeners are at. My faith in Christ is foundational to everything I've done. And I felt a lot of peace in making that decision when Jackie and I were thinking and praying on it. And obviously we can see now, wow, that was spectacular. We got to go on a Super Bowl run and just the highs and lows of the season. You go back to Christmas Day and we lose to the Las Vegas Raiders in a scenario where we had a chance to clinch the AFC West, to punch our tickets to the playoffs. And instead we had to play Cincinnati at home, a team that was playing well with a backup quarterback, to have to punch our ticket. And the way we lost that game was super ugly. And to think that we went on a run and won six straight games to win back-to-back Super Bowls, just special. So we look back on that text from Coach Reed to bring it full circle. And it's funny and you laugh at it, but everything in that organization, and I'm sure we'll talk more about what led to winning, but everything is about winning the Super Bowl there. And it's this unified effort, egos aside, everything's about winning. And I think I saw that early on in the recruiting process and free agency last year.
You mentioned having to rebound from some pretty devastating injuries. I remember back early in your Notre Dame career, I think you had back-to-back season-ending injuries your freshman and sophomore years. These were like injuries that I'm pretty sure some people just were never going to bounce from and never even go back and play more college football, let alone ascend to the NFL. And then you get injured, I think, 3 or 4 years ago with the Chargers, another tough ankle injury. But it just seems like you've developed that kind of resiliency, your body bouncing back, but also just so much of the mental, the psychological. Time and time again, it's just such a common theme when you talk to people who ultimately, and over the course of their full life, achieve great things. It has so much to do with the ability to bounce back. And it's pretty cool because in a way, that's the basis for how this crazy Buser Fellowship began and how we first met Joe. Of course, we met both of you guys through our good mutual friend, Cam McDaniel, number 33, but always number one in our hearts for the Irish. Great guy, but he first connected us with Joe when Joe had his really tough injury his senior year and was really at that crossroads of making the decision on first how to spend the rest of the time that you had while you were on campus and not playing football, and then ultimately to think about whether you were going to come back for a fifth year. And so definitely want to get Joe in there too. And Drew, the same thing. I think we really just all started connecting when you had the free time because you were off your feet and you couldn't really be doing much by way of physical activity. And that led to exploring some other avenues. We're going to talk more about our time together and the way both of you just apply yourselves with excellence to everything you do. And football is just this small microcosm of it. It's even, I think, part of a bigger narrative with you throughout your life, where I think the expectations that were on you were always high, but you always exceeded them. And whether it was in high school, making the jump to play for Notre Dame, and then into the NFL, maybe just talk about what you've learned about how to respond to adversity and how to come back stronger.
Yeah, I think a word that hits home for me that you mentioned, Rick, was resiliency. And I think when you look at successful humans and their journeys, there's always this right theme of ebbs and flows. And you guys get it, obviously, managing people's assets. Joe and I felt it both at the same time at Notre Dame, but you have to develop a sense of resiliency, a way to bounce back when things don't go according to plan. And I think how I developed that sense of resiliency, I think it was a little bit nature. It has always been in me, this determination and drive. But I think too, you encounter people in your life and you get inspired by them. I look back, I was just a freshman at Notre Dame and tear my ACL, and it was really the first significant setback in terms of my football journey I'd encountered. And Joe was going through a rehab process for his ankle at the time, which people won't realize this, but when we lost Joe that season, we took a turn for the worst on defense. I think he got team MVP that season, and I think he only played 8 of the 12 games, which is wild and speaks to how important he was for us. But man, we got going after it on the bike quite a few times. But I think to the theme of resiliency, when you have a belief in yourself, when you have a foundation, when you have good people around you, it makes bouncing back easier. I don't think you can just bounce back on your own. You have to have a community of people around you. And for me, that first time it was Joe. That second time when I tore my ACL 8 months later, it was my brother Justin. But I think throughout my journey, with all the injuries, with all the setbacks, it's been the people in my corner that have helped me, along with the determination that I have in myself and the belief and the hope that I have that I'm going to get through this. But I'd say the people, man, are so important. So important to have good people in your corner.
Joe, what's your earliest memory of meeting Drew? You played the same position at the same school. My mind goes immediately to, oftentimes that's like creates more of a competitive dynamic than a true friendship, but I'm sure it goes either way. But just talk about what it was like meeting each other, playing together, and ultimately developing such a strong bond.
I remember we were recruiting Drew, and it was clear just from the beginning just how dogged you were about your dreams and goals, you know, your whole family, and just your whole MO on that was something that struck me immediately. And I think that I definitely didn't understand at the time, but quickly learned when we were in that rehab process that there were two things that stuck out. And I actually think they're really important, and they were big learning points for me throughout this process. But one, anytime you're dealing with adversity, it's all about understanding first, what's your why? Like, why am I doing this? What am I going after? And having some huge task that's bigger than yourself that you feel like you're being called to do, or it's so important for your life. I think that without that, it's impossible to do the second part of this, which is, I'm quoting Senra, but I do think that it's the best way of putting this, which is excellence is the capacity to take or endure pain. And I think when you have just a huge why, and Drew always had this from the start, he had this crazy vision of going to win the Super Bowl. We wanted to win a national title together at Notre Dame along the way, but unfortunately got close, not quite there. But I do think that those two things are just so fundamental in pushing through at times like this. But from the moment you met Drew, you knew that was just so core to who he was. And it's why you want people like him around you all the time. And so I got really lucky, frankly, when obviously unlucky when I broke and dislocated my ankle, but really lucky to have him around me to be the person pushing me and me pushing him and us iron sharpening iron throughout that process. And at the same time he's doing this, I remember one day I figured out he's like majoring in engineering. He's got like 4.0. I'm like, who is this man? He's an Avenger. So I'm just trying to keep up.
I was just a freshman at Notre Dame when I got to meet Joe. And one of the things that struck me about Joe, and I learned from Joe, was I learned balance in my life. And at Notre Dame, it's so hard to have balance. The demands on you as an athlete are so high. The demands on you as a student are so high. And then everybody is doing something extra at Notre Dame, whether it's being a Buser Fellow, whether it's learning about and figuring out their next career steps. And so you're in this microcosm that is overwhelming at times. And you're trying to figure out, how do I stay afloat with all these excellent people around me? Joe was a really cool and awesome model of that for me. And I thought he understood balance and when to make what moves at the right time and when to allocate what part of his day to each certain thing. And I think that, along with a line my mother gave me, really helped me push through and maybe pass some of those anxiety walls I had in my life. But my mom said, just win, baby. And what she meant by win was what's important now. And I think Joe's ability to balance things and my mom's ability crushed through a message of focusing on what's in front of me at that time were really important in terms of overcoming that.
I still remember those conversations, by the way, from way back. And I remember we had this long talk about basically figuring out how you want to prioritize your life and basically what you're optimizing for now. And I think that's actually a super important thing and to consider. The whole point of this talk is how do we compound over a super long period of time all the learning that we're doing? And I think that in order to do that, at least my opinion, is figuring out what part of your life grid you're optimizing for in that current moment. What's the peak of your pyramid and how do the aspects of your life all work together to get to that peak? And I think at the time for Drew and I, we're obviously trying to be elite athletes, win a national title. To do that, you've got to do a bunch of other things. You can't have any part of that. I think Peter Coffin puts it really well, that multiplicative series of your life, athletic, the academic, the spiritual, the social aspects of your life, none of those can be zeros. Otherwise, the entire thing is a zero. You get kicked off the team if you fail out of school. If you're a terrible human being, you get kicked out of school. Like, it's all these things that you can't have be zeros. But that also means that you can't have 100% in each one of those activities either. You're going to burn yourself out. This is a total marathon of compounding each and every day a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more, and just applying more and more coats of paint. And so I loved watching Drew's journey along that threshold.
Both of you guys have always had this pursuit of excellence, multiple areas at once, and always had that learning bug. But you mentioned Drew's path to Notre Dame. What about you, Joe? You're a California kid.
And Rick, let me interject here. I was doing some of our in-depth research that we typically do for Art of Investing and was able to leverage ChatGPT for a question I had, which is, what are the four most famous modern day alumni? And you got John Hewitt, former Notre Dame Heisman Trophy winner, Matt Leinart, another Heisman Trophy winner for a school that will not be named out in LA, and then Bryce Young, not bad, former Alabama Heisman Trophy winner, and then Joe Schmidt, Buser fellow, big man on campus.
Sounds like ChatGPT had a ref out, had an issue there. So I appreciate you trying to make me feel good there, but there is no way that happened.
I know part of going back there was you're obsessed with Notre Dame football from being a little kid. So maybe that's the thread you can pull on. What drew you to Notre Dame eventually?
I have no idea looking back what started that bug. But when I was 5 years old, this basically as long back as I can remember, my dad sat me down at the kitchen table. He gave me some crayons and a piece of paper and said, go write down your goals, which in hindsight is a ridiculous thing. I can barely write. I'm 5 years old. What do I even know? But that day we came up with three things. One was go to the park with dad. Two was go to Baskin Robbins. And three was play football at Notre Dame. I think obviously the first two, slightly self-serving, my dad wanted to go to the park and get some ice cream. But the third one was uniquely mine from the beginning. And I don't know why I fell in love with the university back then. I think they were on NBC in the time slot that I would have pancakes with my dad. They had really cool helmets. I'm sure at some point I saw Rudy. I don't know, but I was infatuated. And then you learn to understand what the university represents. I got really lucky to be exposed to its aura early on for I don't even know what reasons, but I got really lucky. And through that, I got to meet Drew. I got to meet the two of you. And it's the only reason I'm out here fiddling around in venture capital land. So I think I got very lucky with how the ball bounced for me.
All right. So the famous saying that hangs outside of the Basilica on Notre Dame campus is God, Country, Notre Dame. We're going to have the etching changed to Dad, Ice Cream, Notre Dame.
Yeah, Park, Ice Cream, Notre Dame. It's basically the exact same.
Let's go back to Drew. Say more about where that inclination to study engineering came from.
Well, my dad was an engineer in college. He studied engineer at Auburn. I think math and science just came naturally to me. I was not a reader and a writer. So when I became a Buser fellow in the first task you guys gave me was reading books. I was like, are you serious? I want to look at some of these spreadsheets, figure out how to make some money later in life. I think I naturally clung to math and everybody in the class was way smarter than I was. I literally made my way through on hard work and figuring out patterns and things to get me through each exam. Each exam, each homework assignment was a season of its own. And I just had to figure out a way to just keep stacking days and stacking assignments.
And Joe, was that a similar dynamic with you and just mirroring your dad, seeing what he did with his career in business and private equity?
Yeah, to a certain degree. I think from a really young age, my dad, for context, my dad started his first business when he was 14 years old. He was working with his mom at the flea market in LA, and he was making like puka shell necklaces in the 70s. He then hired his friends to make puka shell necklaces. And that started this really long, lifelong journey of a bunch of random small companies that he ran.
By the way, if he still has any of those shell necklaces, they're very big here in Anna Maria Island.
I'm actually surprised you're not wearing one right now, Rick. You may be. You got to show me your wrists on the video here. But in any event, I think that was my earliest exposure to what work looked like was my dad coming home from work, telling us over the table or walk, or when we would go to Baskin Robbins regularly, taking me and explaining what happened in his day. When we would say prayers at night, we would say prayers for all of our family members, our pets, the dreams that we had. And then there was a whole calendar year where I prayed for a deal with Coca-Cola to go through, because if we didn't get the Coca-Cola deal, we were going to lose the house. Maybe my dad should have not shared that severity with me at the time, but it definitely got me cooking on, hey, this small business thing can be exhilarating. What would it be like to go build new things and form teams? And so I think that experience, though, actually is one of the things that drew me so much into football and into Notre Dame. It's like learning how to work together with a group to achieve something great was something that I just loved from day one. And football, it's such an interesting game. I know there's a lot of talk about, hey, should our kids play football? My wife and I talk about this all the time. And I know this is biased by my own experience, but I just don't know if there's a better way to learn these lessons than to play this 11-on-11 team game. You've got the chance on every play to get your butt kicked. The stakes are higher than it is if you just, maybe you strike out or you lose the race. There's something to it where if I don't bring it and Drew and I are going one-on-one, he's going to put me on my butt. You got to always know how to work together as a team to avoid that reality. That's the beautiful part. And I think a direct result of my relationship with my dad.
Joe, let's go back to this multiplicative series, not to bring up a bad memory, when the ankle injury happens, because it did lead to some good things. That meant that you did have space in your calendar. You had a lot of rehab, but you now were not that season going to be gunning yourself for a national championship. That brought you into our lives a bit and really was the birth of this Buser Fellowship. What's the history of that? How did that come to be? What was going through your mind at that time?
It's important to call out. It's all because of a marketing 101 assignment on Boston Consulting Group. So I was like, okay, I had to get a primary source. Who do I know that worked at Boston Consulting Group? And all of a sudden I meet this strange bird, Paul Buser, through Cam. I remember interviewing you. And then through that, I remember we ended up getting the A, which was awesome. But then I remember we stayed in touch and I got to know Rick through some of the on and off campus Bible study ministry activities that Cam was doing. So we got a little bit closer. And then obviously the ankle injury, which at the time we were 7-1. We should have beat the best team in the nation, former national title winning, Heisman Trophy winning Florida State Seminoles at Tallahassee. And then my ankle gets shattered in 16 different places. The doctors are like, are you going to walk normally again? And I'm like, I want to play football. I'm going from the highest of possible highs, playing my best football in my life, feeling as healthy as I have ever been, to now we're losing games. And I remember sitting in Chipotle when I ran into you guys. And I'm like, I'm out of school to take because I graduated at this point. And that kickstarted this whole conversation of, hey, if I've got 18 months, I've got this time where I'm rehabbing, what should I be doing? And I remember talking to you about that in the Chipotle. And you're like, we're on our lunch break. So I don't know if we necessarily have time to talk about this right now. But why don't you come over to the office and let's talk about it? I was so lucky that happened. But I think the punchline of this is, at the end of the day, these amazing opportunities only come from relationships and keeping really close ties to people who are doing really cool stuff in their lives. And so without that Boston Consulting Group project at Marketing 101, and then the time spent with you, Rick, doing all the fun stuff with Cam, none of this ever happens. And my eyes aren't open to, I would have definitely done the one-year MBA or something like that instead of taking the best of Notre Dame series that we came up with of all the best classes on campus. And then really thinking a little bit more critically about what it is that I wanted to do after school. And I think it just dramatically changed the path of my life. And what I would say for people that are thinking about a transition in their life or students that are exiting school, you don't have to follow the normal path. You can, but there are many different straight lines towards the goal that you want. And I was lucky that you guys opened my eyes to a different path.
such good memories. And I remember a few months later, we were there at lunch with you, and there was a little sign on the table with the local guy who makes kombucha in South Bend. And it said, "We need more owners." And it's talking about the co-op. But we were starting to get into a career talk with you and what you want to do next. And it really struck the three of us at that moment. You need to go own something and really just go on a different path than the typical undergrad. And in true Joe Schmidt fashion, you get the best job of anyone for pretty much that year.
We accomplished a lot that lunch. It was already fairly late in the spring of your fifth year, and you would have had tons of options, traditional options, but there was a bee in your bonnet about just being on some kind of conveyor belt with your career. And it's understandable too, because I think for folks who, whether it's sport or arts or academics, when you taste excellence and you're around excellence, an excellent program, I think it increases your need for excellence in other aspects of your life. And you were really grappling with that. And so when we saw that sign, I think the tension was, man, there's just so much agency out there, so many job stops where you're just another number and you're an agent. And the owner, the become an owner thing, it was really finding high quality people that are embracing things with that orientation of a principle, that this matters, that what we're doing could have impact. We determined that you were going to take two trips, one to San Fran and one to New York for 2 or 3 days each. And we were going to come up with some ownership-oriented people for you to talk with and mainly just get advice. And one of your first meetings was with Ryan Sweeney at Excel. And I think at the time, Ryan was just doing a favor to us.
It was a 15-minute meeting as a favor to you.
Hey, okay, I'll try to give this guy some advice or whatever. But you flipped that conversation.
I got really lucky. And I think this whole Buser Fellowship, steeping yourself in the writing of the best business leaders of all time, really. You guys had me read all of the Buffett letters and just opened the treasure trove of every manager's annual reports and just thinking about all that stuff. And so I do think that period of whatever 18 months or 20 something months that we were together before this process happened was so hypercritical, because it just prepared me to go into these conversations with just a better understanding of what I actually wanted to ask, and flipping the process from just being conveyor belt of who are the biggest sponsors of the business school and what are the biggest analyst or associate programs you could go get access to. Let's go do that because it makes you cool on campus, versus, okay, what's actually right for me and the long-term goals that I have, and where can I expose myself to the right ideas? I think that was just the greatest gift that anyone gave me in my entire university experience. So I thank the two of you for being so thoughtful about it. But those trips you pushed me on. So I ended up going to New York, Chicago, and San Francisco. I went to New York twice, or maybe three times. I slept on James Onwalu's brother's couch, Drew. I basically lived in his house for a little while. So shout out to John. But really the whole idea there was you guys helped me come up with these handful of people that were ownership oriented people and really just go on a information seeking adventure where, hey, what do these people actually do? What's driven happiness for them? What's the path that they took to get to where they went? And it really helped me map all these different jobs that I had no idea what they actually did. And I pretty quickly realized that, hey, I don't think I want to go into the standard banking route or whatever, the consulting route or sales and trading, and just started just ticking down options. And I just took every meeting I possibly could in each one of these places. I ended up learning a bunch before that trip to Excel, just about what might have been right for me. And I remember when I got to Excel and I start this 15-minute conversation with Ryan, all of a sudden it's 15, 30, an hour. I'm asking him all these questions from all this knowledge that I had before of just like, hey man, like this seems really unique. You seem really unique. An hour goes by, 2 hours goes by, he clears his whole damn afternoon. And next thing I know, we're like 5 hours into this conversation. I remember getting back after meeting a bunch of the guys at Excel, which kickstarted the process there. And I remember telling you guys, I was like, man, I had a great conversation with Ryan. He sent me this email and I figured I'd wait to respond until I got back here to ask you guys what you thought. And you're like, he sent you an email. You didn't respond. Respond now. It's the best firm out there. So it was so funny.
I got to throw a shout out to your dad. He endured a lot of pain throughout this. I know he hadn't met Rick or me, I don't think, at that point. Who are these strangers who told you not to get a free graduate degree from Notre Dame? You shun it. You spend this 12 plus months in the wilderness. And I just had a chance at the USC tailgate this fall to give the guy a hug, bury the hatchet. And I think finally he's okay with you missing out on that degree.
Yeah, I think he's okay with how it shook out.
I tell that story several times a year to current seniors who are scrambling, particularly this time of year, right? If you don't have a job, people are nervous, and totally understandably. But I do think it comes back to this idea that a common approach to finding your career is going to lead to a common outcome. you have to approach things in an uncommon way. And in particular, I think in a very personalized way, you got to get on that personal journey of what's right for you. And then the answers just reveal themselves. That'll happen very quickly with those trips, those conversations. But it really, like you said, required just this reorientation and the confidence to do that, which I think is the biggest issue, I think, with so many young people. Again, understandably, I've been there, to just have the confidence to say, I am who I am, and this is what I think I want for myself. So I'm going to go and try and get it. And I might fail. I might not get the job with Excel or whatever, but I'm going to pursue that. And that also comes back something probably connected to that sort of resiliency gene. When you've experienced adversity and you've bounced back from it, there's a lot of adversity in interview process, in careers where you have to be willing to stomach a bunch of no's, for example. And Drew, I bet you've experienced this even across your football career with different teams and everybody having a little bit of a different point of view on your giftings and what your potential contributions can be. But you've got to approach things in that uncommon way if you want even a chance of an uncommon outcome.
Yeah, and it brings it back to the beginning of this conversation, Drew. You talked about Coach Reed and think red, think Super Bowls, right? I'm sure you could have gone and got maybe more money. Maybe you had a different role on some other team, but it was all about the relationship and the people.
I think it's fairly easy to say, hey, Joe, how'd you get here at Notre Dame? And then try to duplicate that. Or, hey, Rick, how'd you go about your career and try to duplicate? I think what the hard thing to do is the self-discovery process of what are my passions, understanding the self so that you can take an uncommon approach. I feel like most people go through life and they just say, what did the people in front of me do? I'm just going to try to copycat that and do the same thing. And I love what you said about common approaches lead to common outcomes. And I think what inspired me so much about Joe was, Joe, I'll never forget you picked me up from Main Circle because I was on crutches from my ACL and you took me around campus. We went to training table together. I think I had just not done well on an exam or something. I was worried about keeping up with the GPA rabbit. And you go, bro, relax. You didn't have a 4.0. You had like a 3.3 or 3.4, no, whatever. But you had all these great things lined up. And I was like, I thought the ingredients for the recipe were you had to have a certain GPA. You had to do these certain things at the career fair. It was black and white for me. And I think that's what a lot of people can probably relate to that. They follow a certain investment strategy or a certain approach to allocation. And there are so many different ways to skin a cat. There's so many different straight lines, like you said, Joe, to get to a certain goal. And you have to figure out through self-discovery and understanding yourself, which one of those paths is best for me, because Paul's path isn't Drew's path and Rick's path isn't Joe's path. We all have a different path. And I think there's greatness inside of all of us. And there's just different ways to bring that out from person to person.
Let's go back to talk a little more Notre Dame football. Joe, you mentioned the Florida State game in 2014. That was the only game that I ever traveled with the team to the game. It was an unbelievable experience. And I mean, just remember vividly being down on the field before the game, very early in preps. And you were just glowing. Came up to us, you were stretching out, whatever. And you just said, isn't this incredible? Isn't this unbelievable that I get to be a part of this? You just had so much legitimate gratitude. I will never forget that moment, because in sport, there's a lot of different ways to approach a big game like that. And being in enemy territory, you just seemed like you were just happy to be there, man. You were just like ready to go, fired up, but also just that gratitude.
I vividly remember that. And I actually remember, and Drew, I'm going to turn it to you in a second here, because I actually sat like maybe a couple rows behind the bench for the Super Bowl. And Drew was very similar. So I remember watching him get ready for the game. He wasn't happy for me. I was cheering for my sister's boyfriend that played for the Niners. But I remember just watching you in the same vibe. So I want to kick it to you to talk about this in a second.
But before you kick it, I want you to know, Drew, that there is something, Joe, called loyalty within the Buser Fellow. Look, we have a very holistic approach to our application process, which is why somebody with your GPA managed to be accepted into the program. But we got to stay together. There's only two of us.
He did wear all white to the game. He did wear all white to try and be neutral. He sent me a picture. But when I found neutral out he was there and he was not inwardly cheering for my team, he was cheering for me, but not for our team. We had some bones to pick, but we sorted it out before this.
Yes, I did wear all white. I had a little Drew Tranquil sticker on my stomach. Just big fan. But I think that sticks back out to me. And I remember running into you guys and giving you a hug or right on the corner of the end zone. But I think that it goes back to when you're prepared, when you go into any situation, whether that's making the biggest trade of your life, deal of your life, it doesn't matter what the stakes are, what the event is. If you've done everything you possibly can to put yourself in a position to have success, one of my old coaches used to always say, the table is set. The banquet has been prepared for you. Now, all that's left is to eat. You're there and you're ready to just enjoy and be present in that moment. I don't think I've ever felt more confident or just more loose and ready than that moment. And I think it's the thing I strive for. It's in every day here at my job. Now, in my relationship, it's if you can go into these big moments and you're just doing all the little things right along the way, there is no anxiety. It all falls away. And you can just have a clear conscience, a clear mind, and just be present in that moment. At the end of the day, too, we're playing a kid's game. I get to go out there and millions of people watching. And what's not to love about that?
What we're talking about, just like at a basic level, is right, handling pressure. And how do you, in these biggest moments seemingly in your life, whether it's the Super Bowl, or maybe you're trying to onboard a client or close a deal or land a job or start a business, it's like, how do you handle those pressure moments? And I think the anxiety comes from expectations for a certain outcome. And I think what has helped me, like in my athletic journey, is I admire the UFC a lot. We talked about like high stakes, high reward environments. I don't know that there is more of one when you go into the cage 1v1 versus somebody, but there was a book I read called The Fighter's Mind. And in it, this guy's just interviewing different MMA artists and guys and gals of the craft. And one of the guys who was a former champion brings to light the point of you can never be scared to lose. You can't fear losing. That can never come into your mind, or else it'll be really hard to be great. And I've tried to distill that and figure out what that means to me. Is to me, the joy of life and the joy of doing anything is all in the journey. And if I'm so focused on the destination or expecting a certain destination, or to bring it back to that Florida State game, Joe, if this is the end all be all and winning this game is what's going to make my life matter, that's going to be pretty hard. When you look back at it, whether or not you win that game or lose that game, greatness can still lie ahead. Whether or not I landed that extension with the Chargers last season, greatness could still lie ahead. I look back at some of the moments in my life where I wanted, if I would have had it my way, it would have gone a certain way. And I look back and I'm like, those were cornerstone moments for getting me maybe to this next point in my life. And to bring it full circle to the Super Bowl, Joe, I remember walking over to my wife and my son Eli before the game. And they're like, oh my gosh, like we're at the Super Bowl right now. What's going on right now? And I remember looking at her. I'm like, babe, I can't lose. Like I can't lose. And I genuinely felt that in my heart. It's one thing to say something, but I really felt that. And I believe that. I said, I can't lose today. And I felt that inside because I'm like, my gosh, I'm looking at my 4-year-old son right here on the field. I'm looking at my high school sweetheart. We're at the Super Bowl right now. And I'm about to go play like the biggest game of my life. And there's going to be a winner and loser in this game. But I felt in my heart of hearts, I'm like, I can't lose because this journey that I'm on, that's all that matters. And whether or not the outcome of this speed bump is a win or a loss, that's not going to define the ultimate outcome. It's just going to be another chapter in the story and in the journey. I think handling those pressure moments, it's all about understanding that in a broad sense, you're just on a journey. There's going to be outcomes within that journey, but focusing or trying to control or expecting those to be a certain thing, that's when you start to not handle pressure well.
I want to ask you about time management, and maybe it's not even time management as much as just the two of you took on a lot outside of football. And it seems like that's been a common thread in your lives, seeing the bigger picture. You both had a serious posture toward academics. You weren't just there to play football. And I know that's not necessarily super uncommon at Notre Dame, but it is uncommon, I think, generally in college sports. But it highlights just that you were making time to have a greater impact and just how you managed to see the bigger picture and respond in a way. Because football, in the context that we're talking about it, it's just so easy to think that that's got to be your everything. And that's going to consume all of your energy, all of your time. But maybe just say more about that more holistic approach that you clearly exhibited back in those college years.
I think it's important to identify priorities. What's most important to you in terms of what you can execute on? I know when I was at Notre Dame, I was dating my now wife. She was going to Purdue. I knew I wanted to marry her. So I was managing a long distance relationship. I knew I was there on athletic scholarship. I knew I had to play football and I knew I had to have decent enough grades to stay on the team. So those were three things I knew I had to do. And then with whatever buckets of time I had left, I could fill them with what I wish to, but you're just a little fish in a big pond. You got to figure out what the heck, how can I make this work? How can I puzzle and piece this together. And I looked at guys like Joe and guys like yourself who were managing families, managing businesses, and you guys meeting with us students and taking time out of your day. And just through time, trial and error, figured out a rhythm and a routine that worked for me. But I think at the core too, after identifying priorities, what really matters in life? When I get down to it, what do I want my life to be remembered as? And I think one of the core things that really struck a chord with me is people matter most in life. Life's all about people. And so if I invest my time into building strong relationships with my wife, with my friends, with my teammates, if I use my talent and abilities to help vulnerable people, you find ways to get involved in your community and use your talent and abilities to better others. I think you can figure out a blend of things that works for you and is meaningful and has all those ingredients of a value-filled life.
I don't know if I could put it any better than that. I think that I would totally emphasize and echo what Drew said. It's like all about the relationships and the people that helping and building a life together with in the community that you're in. And I think that the one thing I might add to what Drew said is across those parts of your life, obviously there's only so much energy you have that you can apply across all those aspects. But interestingly, I think the more you end up doing certain types of activities, the more you realize they're actually not energy exertion, they're energy adding. You've got to have the right mix of people. You want to guard your neck against the energy vampires. You want to go find the people who are going to add to your energy bucket as much as you possibly can.
I'm excited to tell you about our presenting sponsor, Hunt Club, the leading tech-enabled executive search firm. For Rick and me at Sader Grove, one of our obsessions is identifying and cultivating talent. Selfishly, it's one of the reasons we teach Art of Investing. The class allows us to get an unfair, early glimpse at some of the best talent out there. But we all know the talent universe is vast and competitive, so beyond simply relying on our own networks, we've partnered with Hunt Club to assist us and our portfolio companies with all things search. Through its proprietary software and approach, Hunt Club is able to harness the networks of literally thousands of leading professionals to make warm introductions and personal referrals during a search. In our minds, gone are the days of relying on only one recruiter's Rolodex or on simply who's top of mind that week. By leveraging Hunt Club's network and technology, we've been able to unlock much more powerful connections, and we've been able to consistently find the right people for the right roles. So if you're looking to truly harness the power of networks with the ideal solution for all of your talent needs, visit huntclub.com/AOI to learn more and get connected with our good friends over at Hunt Club.
So much of what both of you shared just reminds me of that awesome podcast that Drew did with Tony Dungy a couple of years ago, and we'll put the link in our class notes. It's so easy, whether you're a coach or you're a player or the CIO or an analyst, it's so easy to just be overwhelmed by your particular task at hand and to force yourself into this either or around approaching these other aspects of life, like serving others. And yet the paradox, as Coach Dungy put it, I think, and you all just echoed, is just, it's not either or. And if you do it in a certain way, it can actually fuel success and excellence. And I think it's a good transition just to talk to you, Drew, a little bit more about what you experienced with the Chiefs, because you did accomplish the extraordinary in winning a Super Bowl. And there is something extraordinary in the water there now. I think it is safe to call the Chiefs the current dynasty in the NFL. Maybe just talk a little bit about what is the anatomy of a dynasty and of a Super Bowl winning program.
There's a lot of layers to the onion. I'll try to peel them back in a way that's meaningful.
One really important layer that has some poofy hair and cannon for an arm that we probably shouldn't overlook.
That's true. But this season, everybody kept going back to the defense, right?
But I'll touch on Coach Dungy for a second. He's obviously a Super Bowl winning coach too. He's got the pedigree. And I think that 2007 Colts team, I believe, looked a lot different than the 2023 Kansas City Chiefs. Getting back to our point of there's multiple ways to skin a cat, but I think there are a few critical ingredients. I loved his mindset about Coach Dungy's mindset. Like, he walked in there, his first team meeting, he goes, "Hey guys, we're going to be really involved in the community." That's what he opened up with. Our community, the people around us, they're going to feel us. We're not just going to be a football team here in town. Like, they're going to feel us here. We're going to be involved. We're going to get involved. And I think when you can get players to buy into something that's bigger than themselves, I think it creates this sense of momentum. I think that's what he did there. I think it's certainly what Coach Reed is doing and has done in Kansas City. When I look at some of the ingredients we had, because I've just been here for 1 year, they've been to, I think, 3 Super Bowls without me, and they've won 2 other without me during this run that they have. So I'm a small piece to the puzzle. But what I observed this year, and I think it's likely the top ingredient you have to have in any organization, any team, is good leadership. They don't just have good leadership, they have great leadership, and it's at every level. It's the ownership, it's the coaches, it's the players. In the NFL in particular, you have to have the area of that that in my mind might matter most is the player leadership. And I'll take us to Baltimore, AFC Championship game, and it's halftime. I want to say the game was 10-0 or 10-7 at this point. They call 2-2, which basically means you got 2 minutes. Coach is going to come up and talk. And 2 minutes pass. Coach Reed comes up to talk, starts to say what he's going to say. And Travis Kelce just starts like screaming over top of Coach Reed and just takes over the whole halftime spiel. Players were like, I can get on board with that. I can get on board with that energy because he's not just saying it. There's an element of competency too in all of this. Like you have to have good leadership. You have to have good leader is not somebody who just can say the right things at the right time. It's somebody who can actually execute on what they're saying. And Travis at that moment, at that critical moment, that critical junction node in our season was the leadership we needed to go out there in the second half and execute and win the game. So I think leadership is a critical ingredient that we had this year. The other thing I'll say, and this was our word for the year, it was united. That was what we opened April 2023 in our first team meeting. It's, hey, the word for our team this year is united. There's, I think, many reasons Coach Reed chose that word outside of you're the current Super Bowl champion. You're going to get everybody's best shot. We got to be united in this thing. But I think what he meant by that was a collective mindset unified towards a common goal. And that goal for us was hoisting another Lombardi trophy and doing it in back-to-back years is something that's only been done a handful of times in the NFL. And the unified mindset towards winning, there were no egos in that organization. And that's something we all have. We all have egos and we all want to be the star of the story. We all want to play an important role. But one thing that was so different in Kansas City, maybe from my other years of experience in the NFL, is nobody was talking about their free agency contracts. Nobody was talking about what's next. Nobody was talking about how many catches they were getting or how much playing time they were getting. There are subtle jokes or stuff of this, that, and the other, but everything was about winning. Everything was about winning the next game. Everything was about finding a way to win that game, to move on, and to ultimately hoist the Lombardi and win at the end. And I think that obsession with winning and that unified mindset is what carried this team. Those are two key ingredients. And then the ball has to roll your way a couple times during a season, a long season. And some people call it luck. I call it preparation meeting opportunity. But there's going to be moments where you have to capitalize maybe on another team or another company or another person making a mistake. And you have to be ready to seize that opportunity, whether that's via a turnover or you look at that third down play in overtime where Chris Jones comes free. How does Chris Jones come free? He's the best defensive player on the football field. He comes free because they bust a protection. And Chris did a great job of running and not leaving his feet and forcing the errant throw there back out to the right side of the end zone to force him to field goal. And we ultimately know Pat goes down the field and they score a touchdown to win the game. Some people, like I said, call it luck. I think it's more capitalizing on opportunities when they present themselves. So you got to have those three things. And I think we had all of those this year.
When you think about how countercultural this is, to me, it's just fascinating to think that you could have, even just over this half dozen years, that winning culture emerge, be maintained and improved. I would love to get your guys' reaction to the current state of the world. I think we heard this stat recently that in the last 4 years, all 32 offensive coordinators in the NFL have changed teams. And there's just a massive amount of change. And even in your time at Notre Dame, we had Diaco, Van Gorder, Elko, Clark Lee as defensive coordinators during your time. And that's only moving faster. What are your reflections on how to deal with that as a player? Maybe Joe, employee at Excel, partner at A16Z now. Generally in life, either being part of systems where some of that's out of your control, but also influencing the way that maybe you can latch on to some of those great leaders when they might be moving around.
I think it's a great question. At the end of the day, you've got to focus on what you can control ultimately. I remember when Diaco left, obviously when BBG came in, we had an entirely new system. We had a bunch of people graduating. And I remember going into that first spring practice and trying to learn an entirely new system. And I'm a brand new leader, if you will. At the time, it was still basically a walk-on remnant. There's no way this kid plays kind of thing. And so I remember going through the first couple of days of install, trying to learn the system and being totally overwhelmed. For people who don't know, the scheme that we were running, to put it simply, was an extraordinarily complex scheme. There were many different plays, and many of them resulted in me making some sort of check or getting us into the right play, which made this challenging. I actually ended up loving it. I did see the beauty in it, but the first couple of days were not beautiful because I had no idea what I was doing. And so I just remember thinking to myself, all right, what can I actually control in this practice? It's my effort, my enthusiasm, and my communication with my teammates around me. At the end of the day, we're all doing the wrong thing, but it's the same thing. We have a much better chance than if we're all doing something random and it's very different things across the group. So that's the first thing I thought. And the second thing is, if I'm just hyperactive and basically making everything right with effort and enthusiasm, you can actually get a pretty long way. And I remember those first few days of practice, that was what I communicated to all the people around me. And it just spread like wildfire. And all of a sudden we're flying around. We're actually kicking the offense around. And so I think it was a learning moment for me where there are going to be these environments where things change very quickly. There's some new leader of your team, your company is sold, something happens. And all of a sudden everything on the field is different. In those moments, what I've learned is just focus on the people around you, making sure everyone's on the same page, and then building from a collective effort that is, all right, we're just going to go all in and we're going to figure out how to fix it as we go through this. And I've seen that happen with companies. I've seen that happen in different types of organizations. And I think that the ones where people retreat and almost play scared in the football term, but play cautious, play safe, it's more about just trying to own that opportunity and try to push things forward.
I'm just chuckling in my mind because I think there's an incredible case study with the linebacker situation when we transitioned into Coach Van Gorder's defense. You had Joe Schmidt, who 6'1", shorter arms. And then you have Jalen Smith. And I don't know if your listeners know who this guy is. Five-star athlete, meaning you're the best of the best. Coming into Notre Dame, freakishly fast, strong. And so you've got these two guys playing next to each other. But to the point, I remember Joe telling me, I'm like, Joe, what's your approach? He's like, I had to figure out what works for me. Like, how am I going to stay on the field? And he goes, my thing was, I'm going to be irreplaceable. I'm going to be the guy who gets absolutely everybody in the right spot. And I'm going to be so good at it that they can't take me off the field. And I was like, interesting. I was like, even though he was not probably one of the two most athletic guys in the room or most talented guys, here's a guy who walked on, found a way, getting back to that self-evaluation, figured out what he was great at and what he could find a way to stay on the field. And he said, I'm just going to be irreplaceable. They're not going to be able to take me off the field. We've got a new system. I'm going to be really good at understanding it. And I'm still going to be good enough to make plays and do all the things I need to do. And so his competency was there, but he found a facet that made him irreplaceable. And when he did that, it's a fascinating case study because here he is playing next to maybe one of the best linebackers to ever play at Notre Dame and would have been a top probably five pick had he not got hurt in that Ohio State game in Jalen Smith. And Joe's out there running around with him and playing right beside him. Some I'll always laugh at and think back on.
I always laugh at Coach Diaco. He used to always say, and I think this is really important actually for everybody. I think it's funny you say it that way, Drew, but he always used to say the worst thing you can do is lie to yourself. And I remember as a young player, there are a lot of lies you can tell yourself. This is actually just a funny quick story. I think it was my freshman spring. The next year we go to the national title. This is Manti Te'o almost wins the Heisman Trophy and the team has on the storybook season. But going into that year, we're in spring football. I'm still a walk-on. I am literally the fifth string linebacker. There are not five strings. So I am so far from playing. It's not even funny. And in spring ball, you basically have these grueling 2-hour practices. We play super high contact events. And I very rarely would play. I would do all the scout team stuff before we'd have competition periods at the end of practice. But at the end of these practices, I would sometimes get 3 or 4 throw the kid a bone plays at the end of a 10 play sequence. We go into this 5 a.m. meeting. And we're in there and we're going through plays and Coach Diaco is coaching up Manti. He's coaching up Dan Fox, played in the NFL. He's coaching up Prince Chembo, playing in the NFL. All these guys who play in the NFL. Finally, like play with me comes up and I'm on the screen and I'm like, wow, I'm on the screen. This is incredible. I can't wait to get coached. And I realize I'm walked out over number 2. This is a bad play. And so the film starts running. He goes back and forth 4 or 5 times. The guy runs by me, catches the ball, touchdown. For anyone who knows football, they're running RPO on me as the guy they're optioning. And I get frozen like a deer in headlights and they throw it over my head. 30, 40 seconds go by and coach says nothing. And finally he goes, Joe, why am I going to put you in the game? And I look forward and I see Manti. I see Dan. I see all these guys who play in the NFL and they're all obviously better than me at this point. And my first thought is I'm not going in the game, barring some horrible catastrophe. And after a couple seconds, I blurt out, I'm quicker. And coach, he maybe uses some colorful language, says, that's incorrect. And Dan Fox, what's your 40 time? And Dan lists his 40 time off. Dan was faster than me. He goes, Joe Schmidt, what was your 40 time? And I was like, something slower than him. And then he goes, Dan Fox, what's your vertical leap? And Dan goes, 40 or something like that. And he goes, Joe Schmidt, what's your vertical leap? I go, 27. He goes, 24. And so he goes down the list. He's just telling me all the things that are, I'm not athletic, basically.
This is reminding me of the Rudy scene where you're 100 and nothing, 5 foot
not
nothing.
Not a speck of athletic.
And by the way, I'm overemphasizing some of this for the comedic effect, but not the time series or what he said. And a minute and a half goes by and he's like running through all these lists and I'm scrambling in my brain. What am I going to say here to get him to stop? And people are looking at me like, Joe, you got to say something. And finally I go, I got to be perfect. And as soon as I said that, the whole thing stopped. Everything was clear and it all made sense in that moment. And to Drew's point, it's all right, how do you become irreplaceable in an organization? If you're perfect and you find a way to just make the group operate more perfectly, there is tremendous value in that. And so I remember getting to know Brian Van Gorder, who was an incredible defense coordinator in the NFL, someone who's going to do the right thing every single time. That is tremendously valuable. And you can start to work on that. And that's how, frankly, if you're striving for perfection in everything you do every single day, that's how compounding can really take hold. Then every single practice that I would go into, it's no longer about the mistakes. I understand what I need to do. Sure, I may have limitations, but each and every day I get a little bit better with my hand placement. I get a little bit better at identifying the play. All of a sudden I am playing as fast as Jalen. And all of a sudden I am making the plays I shouldn't make. I'm intercepting Jameis Winston. So I do think that's a really important point that came out of this whole experience.
One of the things that I'm hearing from both of you is just how you just embrace change. We see this in investing. We see it in careers and just the mindset of people. On the one hand, it's very popular to say you're about growth and want growth opportunities or growth mindset. And yet on the other hand, so few people really respond to change as though it's a good thing. And yet, of course, growth by its definition is a form of change. It requires change in order to grow. And we just had Katie Koch of TCW in class a couple months ago. And she made the point about when you as a leader usher in change, one of the really critical things is to help everybody to see that actually, no, this isn't something you should be running from or scared about. This is the opportunity here because change and evolution is inevitable. And you've got to be able to embrace the opportunity to grow into something beyond where you are right now. And by the way, that's also, I think, where a lot of the joy comes from and a lot of the fun in life and the sort of release of our creative spirits to take on new challenges. But there is this paradox that we all want growth, but we don't necessarily want change. And before we adopt a growth mindset, we really need to adopt more of a change mindset. I think one of the things, and you touched on compounding, Joe and Drew, in the context of football, you both have experienced this. Joe, as you said, it's a different sport. You take hits with a high frequency. It's interesting to think about compounding in the context of a profession where your duration is really capped. What's the average career of an NFL player? It's 3 or 4 years or something like that. And you have these outliers. And I know Drew's going to be one of those outliers. But it does remind me of another thing that Coach Dungy had said on your pod, Drew, which was a lot of players have struggled with taking that next step beyond football. You've got to have something to be running toward. And you've got to be setting up your life in a way where on the one hand, you're all in on what you're doing in football, but you're also setting up the chess pieces in a way where you're ready for the next thing. And it's a little bit of a pun intended because we're talking to also the NFL Super Bowl equivalent chess champion. Most of our listeners may not know this, that Drew won a competition, I think it was sometime last year, a fundraiser, and he's officially crowned the top chess player in the entire National Football League. But I'm curious, just Drew, what's your mindset today? You've got more football in front of you. There's X's and O's to take care of, and there's a lot more you want to do. And I want to hear about your ambition, especially after achieving the pinnacle. How does that, if in any way, reorient your goals and your ambitions around what you want from the sport? But then I'd love to hear just how you're thinking about life after the sport and how you're starting to frame that and prepare yourself for that, knowing that it's not really fully in your control.
Yeah, one of my core metaphors for life, and it comes from a simple book called Enjoy the Ride by Steve Gilliland. It's like 100 pages. And I read it back in high school, but it's this idea of you're never arriving. They're ridding yourself of this destination disease. And for a lot of people, the Super Bowl in my profession would be the destination. But Steve argues, and I believe that it's all about the journey. These are just like train stops and the train just keeps moving. And so it's funny, I'm back in the gym this week and I'm like so hungry to get back training and to get back after this thing and just to keep improving. And I think maybe why I feel that way is I'm learning more and more each day to just find joy in the journey and realizing that if I was just to get handed that Super Bowl, one of the things that made this Super Bowl so special to me was the journey like to get there. I think back on my injuries. I think back on how this past year went in free agency. I think about our team's story this year of how it wasn't the typical Kansas City Chiefs teams that people were used to seeing. We were thriving more on defense than we had in years past. We were finding ways to win that we hadn't in years past. We went through probably four of the top six teams in the NFL to do it in the playoffs and to win the big one. And I think just like enjoying the ride. And I think something good can come towards focusing your energy on one thing and this thing being football, but change is inevitable. And like you said, the career span for a player in the National Football League is not long. And so there is going to be a next step in life. And this multidisciplinary approach of finding other things that pique your interest, it is important. And I love what you're saying about change, but change too. And everybody knows this, listeners know this, is change is painful too. It's very painful. And I remember uprooting my family this past year and moving them to Kansas City after we had really felt like we got settled in here in California and met a lot of friends. And suddenly we're in a new area where we don't know anybody. And we certainly don't know resources like my body work and things that I'm used to getting that are part of my routine. And we're not around our church anymore. And the restaurants aren't the same. And the grocery store is a different distance from your house. And there's all these things that you have to figure out, but it goes back to the resiliency is required to do great things in life. That's an ingredient, and change is coming whether we want it or not. You got to be ready to face it.
Joe, what's that been like for you, that transition? I want to hear more about just your experience as an investor, because you've achieved a lot in a short time. You did some great things with Excel. You went on, I think, one of their portfolio companies, Ethos, to work within a corporate setting before joining Andreessen. And it seems like you're loving the craft of investing. But tell us, was that change difficult? Have you just managed to root yourself in another passion?
Yeah, extraordinarily difficult. I think that obviously we talked about Ryan and the guys in the group really taking a chance on me. I wanted to honor that chance and try to ramp as quickly as humanly possible. But there's a heck of a lot you need to learn. Sometimes I equate it to you're on like some sort of cliff. You're reaching for the next lip and it's 15 feet up and you've got my vertical. You're scrapping and you're clawing. You're trying to figure out how to get up there. And so I think that it's obviously a challenge. I think that at the end of the day, though, it's all about trying to lean back on the principles that we've talked about in all these different environments. This is a huge moment where you got to refocus on what you can control. All right, how do I restart the compounding journey? And all right, we got to basically first start by, all right, what is my pinnacle goal here? How do I optimize everything in my life around this pinnacle goal? How do I control the things on a day-to-day basis such that I can continue to like doggedly pursue that over a long period of time? And I think that was probably the hardest part for me, at least. I think this is actually the hardest part for a lot of people who end up leaving the game, football, is you go from the absolute pinnacle of millions of people watching you. And I don't know if I knew everything about like defense and football and technique, but I knew way more than I could have ever imagined. And so all of a sudden, all that knowledge is basically, at least on the schematic side, fairly useless, but you've got all this stuff on people dynamics. So it's like, how do you take that and rebuild all of the industry knowledge that you need to be successful? I was lucky enough to have some people at Excel that really believed in me and invested in me. And then I joined a great group at Ethos and got to experience what it's like to actually touch the metal of building a company, right? And create something from zero and learn how hard that is to go make a dollar and then a million and then 10 and then beyond. And build a team. And now I get to apply that at amazing firm with amazing people and Andreessen Horowitz, which is an unbelievably humbling honor. But at the end of the day, it all comes back to, in any of these moments, how do you optimize your day? How do you optimize your life around these big goals and be comfortable with the fact that you're going to start back from square zero? And that's the fun, to Drew's point. There is no joy in getting things handed to you.
What, Drew, about Andreessen would surprise people from the outside? It's obviously a storied firm that is public in many dimensions, and probably a lot of people have different perspectives on. In a way, it's been an iconoclast in the venture community over the last few decades. But from the inside, what have you grown to understand about what makes A16Z special?
I think with any great organization, it always starts and ends with people. And so I think Mark and Ben from the start had a clear vision of what they wanted to do, how they wanted to build this place to be truly unique. Because at the end of the day, we're investing dollars. And my $100 bill and your $100 bill and Drew's $100 bill, Ho's from Altos and Brad's, they're all the same. And so it's like, how do we make sure that we help people understand what about ours is different and what about this firm makes it unique? And so I think that that's what I think from the outside is somewhat clear. But when you live inside this organization, you understand the excellence that everyone's pushing for each and every day, what makes all of the experts across all the fields so unique, but also, frankly, how many things that the firm has to offer, right? There's 600 people that work here and a very large services organization. So I think that all the different ways that we can help companies is just a super unique value proposition. And so I love working here. I'm so honored and humbled to do so.
I did want to ask for both of you guys, I know how important coaches can be in shaping your life as a player at any level. Going back to like little league sports, maybe if each of you could just share, there is that one coach that you would point to that you just want to shine a light on, had a major impact in your life.
Yeah, Clark Lee, our defensive coordinator, my last season at Notre Dame. He's now the head coach at Vanderbilt, but I'll never forget that fall camp. I wasn't having the best camp. I'd played better football. And he brought me in his office and goes, I want to tell you a story. He told me a story about this purple prune bush outside of his front house. He said, I'd walk home day after day and I could have had a good day. I could have had a bad day. But for whatever reason, I'd walk in the front door and something was irking me and something would cause me to feel a certain way. And he noticed after a few weeks of doing it that he didn't like these bushes, these purple prune bushes outside of his house. They were overgrown and whatnot. And he said, the point of the story, Drew, is I had to go in there and I had to cut all the dead growth off these purple prune bushes. And they looked really ugly at first, but after a couple months, like they actually grew and some of the dead growth that was on there allowed for new growth to come. And he goes, I'm really seeing that in you right now. I think there's a lot of things you need to cut out maybe of your life, of your approach, of your mind. I think you're focusing on things. And I was focusing on the NFL and what was next and how do I set myself and position myself up and how do I make sure I have good stats and all these things that are out of my control, like Joe's been saying the whole time and don't matter. That was a monumental moment for me.
And for me, probably my high school football coach, his name's Bruce Rawlinson. He's a great man. Coached at my high school for, I don't know, 40 years or something like that. I think he was the first person to really break down my mind and help me understand how hardened you need to be as a competitor and how serious you need to be about your craft. And so I credit him for giving me the opportunity to first encounter adversity. And he laid out a big challenge for me. There was a time where I didn't know if I wanted to meet that. And then once you cross that frontier, you never want to go back. And so I think that I have to credit him.
On our final question here, guys, I'm not sure either of you have come into contact with a former faculty member at Harvard Business School, Clay Christensen, very famous in the early stage investing community that Joe's familiar with because of his book, Innovator's Dilemma, and all the work around that and all the amazing CEOs and investors that he had as students. But Clay, later in his life, wrote a book called How Will You Measure Your Life? And very much focused on framing the essence of what we really ultimately want. I think his real vision was to wake people up early in their lives to see that they needed to find that personalized lane that we were talking about with a career, with the whole of life, and establish what you really want to accomplish and what you want to be about in advance so that you can have a better chance of fulfilling those goals. But we like to ask people just in their own personal context, how ultimately will you want your life to be measured? Maybe we'll start with you, Joe.
I think for me, it all comes down to the people that you impact and how you impact them. And so I think right now it starts and ends with my wife and the family that we're building. And I want to try to be the husband and eventually the father that pushes our family forward and leaves this place better for us being a part of it. I think it goes into all the service that we would like to do as a family and really the impact that we want to leave. At the end of the day, we're here for such a brief moment on this earth. And so I think it's all about those relationships, the people, and what you can try to drive forward. And so I'm very privileged that three of those relationships are the three of you. And so I'm honored that I was on this podcast with you guys and you allowed me to be a guest here. So this can be a small grain of sand on all the impact that I hope I can be humble enough to hope for.
I was fortunate enough to take a class in my last year at Notre Dame called Heart's Desire. And it talked a lot about one of the activities they had us do was we had to walk through the cemetery there on Notre Dame's campus and read all the headstones. And the activity was eulogy virtues or eulogy resume versus your physical career resume or your life resume. And it was like making the argument that your eulogy resume matters more. What do you want people to say at your eulogy? Then that's the question here. I feel like sometimes it's so hard to see the forest through the trees. We all want to be great at our job. We want to be remembered for being competent and good at what we do. I certainly want to be remembered as a great linebacker and someone who left no stone unturned. But when I read those tombstones, much to what Joe already said, man, I want to be a God-fearing father and a loving husband to my family, first and foremost. Those are the people that, like, my kids are my closest, like, disciples. Forget about teaching or influencing other people. How about the people that live under my own roof? How about my wife, who's amazing and has sacrificed so much for our family to be in the position they are today? So I owe it first and foremost to those people. I owe it. I want to be remembered as a good son to my parents. And we've talked about Joe's dad and his mom and how incredible they were and our siblings. So I think you just want to live for a cause bigger than yourself. And you helped people. People weren't a means to an end for you. It was a joint effort, a joint journey where there were win situations. We talk about Peter Kaufman. One of the things I love about him is he preaches win scenarios and win relationships. And I want to be remembered as a guy who was never using people as stepstones, but was arm in arm going through this journey, this battle that we're all on, which is this hard, crazy life.
Want to go quickly, go alone. You want to go far, go together with this crew and the Art of Investing. Let's go.
I am not a supreme being, but if I were measuring your lives from my vantage point, I would say both of you are off to a great start. I expect a lot more. I think the impact, the potential that both of you have is immense. And honestly, it's been such a privilege for both of us to know you first as more teachers and mentors, but to have that grow into a friendship where I really learned so much from watching you guys do life.
Paul, yeah. Rick, what do you guys want to be remembered as? Each have 60 seconds or less.
I love what both of you have said and this idea of family first and foremost, but really using another Peter Kaufman idea on reciprocity, knowing that it's a super powerful force in the universe, but hopefully harnessing our lives in a way where we give a lot without expecting too much in return or not really caring when it comes back to us. I think that's always stuck with me. And so I think if you end up having some of those sorts of inputs, that the eulogy virtues hopefully will take care of themselves.
Yeah, I love hearing each of your reaction to this question. And it is such a central question. On the one hand, we all answer it a little bit uniquely. And on the other, it's like we're describing different notes of a same song. We seem to all be wired in a way where we deep down understand that the centrality of life is ultimately about others. We were at the Founders Only Conference recently in Austin, which, by the way, was so much fun, hanging out with David Senra and 150 of his closest friends. And the same question was asked to us. And my response there was that the meaning of life is to find your gift, and the purpose of life is to give it away. And that is not my quote. That is Pablo Picasso, but it makes me sound smart. What I like about it is it roots the human experience in, first, it's an exciting adventure. We are on an adventure seeking to find our gift. And just beyond that, do I leave it all on the field? We've been talking a lot of football, but there is this sense that when we get to the end of life, we just want to have nothing left. We want to have given it our all.
All right, boys, we are out of time and let's get back out there. Let's win a few more Super Bowls. Joe.
Win some Peloton contests.
Maybe win a few deals in the fintech space.
We'll check back in periodically on the Buser Fellowship group and see how you're doing. But rest assured, we're just so proud of the both of you guys. Get so much joy from the friendship. So thanks for the time today. And thanks for all you guys are doing out there in the world.
Thank you, guys.
We love you guys. Thanks.
Thanks so much for showing up to class today. For more Art of Investing episodes and to explore all of the resources we mentioned today and more, check out staygrovey.com. That's stay, G-R-O-V-E-Y.com. That's it for now, and we'll see you next time.